It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked to a doctor who gave us some helpful tips on how to start your mental health care journey. But finding an available counselor to begin that process with is not a guarantee for everybody. We're in the midst of a nationwide shortage of therapists. There aren't enough licensed providers to meet the needs of everyone who could benefit from some kind of therapy. One solution that's been getting support is training lay counselors as a way to provide counseling services to people with mild to moderate mental health concerns. An expert on counseling psychology joins us now to explain recent efforts to train non-traditional providers to help address a nationwide therapy shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a tough time finding an available therapist to meet your mental health needs in your community? Would you consider seeing a trained lay counselor instead? Somebody with maybe not as much training, but still some training, or work with a peer counseling group? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bruce Wampold is an emeritus professor of counseling psychology at UW-Madison. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get to this idea of lay counselors, what are you seeing out there in terms of a shortage of therapists? How big a problem is this right now?
Well, you described it well. There are not enough trained therapists to serve the population that's suffering from various types of mental distress. As well, our health system isn't really set up so that even if there were therapists, accessing an effective therapist is difficult. There's very little information about which therapist would be best for which type of patient, to know who would be effective to work with. It's a really complicated process, and the environment just makes it difficult to find the right help that's needed for every person.
And that brings us to this idea, and I hadn't heard of until pretty recently, the idea of trained lay counselors who might not have those advanced degrees we might expect. Can you talk about this concept of lay counselors?
Well, we need to be careful how we say this. You know, peer counseling, peer support has been around for decades. So this is not something that's new. It's generating more publicity because of this shortage of therapists. But basically, the idea is that these are providers who have the skill to be able to help people. They receive training. It may not be the best fit for everybody, but the evidence is pretty clear. It's effective for many people suffering from various types of disorders.
Yeah, and I want to distinguish here between peer counseling and lay counseling. Can you talk a little bit about peer counseling, which I have heard a lot more about over the years?
Well, the terms aren't a definite designation. So it isn't something we can say, here's the definite difference between a lay counselor and a peer counselor. Basically, the idea is that these are individuals who are selected because of their skill, given additional training, but they, as you said, don't have advanced degrees. In many instances, they're as effective as trained therapists. You know, there's a great variability in the outcomes by various therapists. We all know some are more effective than others. It depends on the match with the patient, perhaps. But peer counselors also have a range of skill and expertise. So we don't want to say it's necessarily a second tier level of service. It depends on the preference of the person seeking help. You know, many people would prefer to see a lay counselor or a peer counselor than they would a trained therapist. Less stigma, more kind of a feeling of equality rather than hierarchy, although trained therapists should work collaboratively with patients. But we shouldn't think of it necessarily as a tier, you know. You're going to get a psychologist, maybe a licensed professional counselor, a psychiatrist, and then underneath all of that is this lay or peer counselor. It depends on your needs, what your problems are, and what you prefer.
For that lay counselor, someone might worry, well, anybody could claim to be a lay counselor. Rob Ferret could do it, and he'd be terrible at the job. What are some of the basics? What are some of the bare minimums you'd want to see people be trained in before they hang out their shingle?
Well, I've worked with several groups with lay counselors, and the important part is, and we have the technology and the science to be able to do this, is to pick people who have the skills to be effective counselors. You know, we should do the same with therapists as well. And then to give them additional training to monitor the outcomes they achieve with the people they're working with, so that there's some assurance by some organization that these people are working effectively. So, you know, it's not too much different than going to seek a therapist. We really don't have much information as consumers about who the most effective therapists are. Same with peer counselors or any other really helping professional.
Bruce Wampold is with us, Emeritus Professor of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, talking about the idea of lay counselors with at least some kind of skills, qualifications, and training being a part of our mental health care system. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Bruce, do you see ways that our current system of healthcare could better integrate peer and lay counseling to make sure that they are accessible and available for people who want and need them?
Well, I think you ask a very important question here. In our health system, it's difficult to incorporate this time of help within the system. I mean, we have the third-party payers, insurance companies, government programs, and it's not easy to fit this idea of peer counseling into those models. Now, there are some model programs that are being rolled out in some locations to be able to do this. But it's an idea that really ought to be investigated and tested to see whether this would improve over the various locations an adequate provision of services.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey, so my background is theology, and we cannot get enough pastors to serve our churches. So we have lay pastors now. They do a good job. Theology, psychology, they're both the soft sciences. We can't get enough people to go to the university and become classically trained as a counselor. I'm curious what this is saying about the movement in our country where the soft sciences, we cannot get people to consider. Is it a financial thing? I'm just curious. What's the story behind the shift in our culture?
Mark, thanks for the call. I think some psychologists might argue with the soft science designation, Bruce, but Mark's point that people, is this true? People aren't necessarily pursuing these kind of careers, even in the more, what we might think of as traditional paths toward becoming a therapist?
Well, the problem is not the pipeline with people desiring to become professionals. For instance, at the university in counseling psychology, we have many more applicants than we have places in the programs. So the problem isn't people seeking these careers. The problem is there just isn't the infrastructure to train more people. So that's one of the issues. The other issue, I mean, we might as well talk about this, is that the way our society is set up, we are suffering a pandemic of mental health distress. We live in a stressful society. So you could double or triple the number of therapists and still not be able to meet the demand, because it's just a stressful environment that we live in. And we know stress exacerbates any vulnerability for mental distress.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Bruce Wampold, Emeritus Professor of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at the idea of training lay counselors to provide more access to mental health care, as well as access to peer counseling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a licensed mental health care provider, have you noticed a lot of demand for your services? Have you had to turn potential clients away? If you've been seeking some kind of help, what are you running into in your community? Is there the help you need nearby, the right kind of help? What do you think about the idea of expanding the pool of lay counselors to try to help tackle this shortage? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Bruce Wampold, Emeritus Professor of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at the idea of using more lay counselors trained in mental health care strategies to address a nationwide therapist shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you yourself offer mental health support in your community as a medical professional, pastor, religious leader, peer support, or as a friend? Would you consider being trained as a lay counselor yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hello.
Hello. Wonderful program. So we have a daughter who is exactly in this position, early 40s, and would like to make a difference in people's lives. She's been frustrated thinking, applied for social work degrees and there aren't enough spaces for people to get in, thinking she could eventually do therapy. She's got a, certified yoga instructor. She finds herself in leadership positions in various organizations, and she's sought out for personal advice and help from people. As her parents, we're wondering, what's the legal liability insurance side of this, and where would our daughter go to get training that's being described? Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for the call. Great question. Bruce, what would somebody's path to becoming a lay counselor be? Do we have an established path to do that?
Well, there's not a track for becoming a peer counselor as there is for becoming a professional counselor, for instance. There are several online services that provide peer counseling that somebody can access and apply to, be trained, and provide those services. They actually pay the peer counselors a reasonable wage for doing this. And many people do this as a part-time position because it brings satisfaction. They are providing a necessary service to people who need it. They're naturally empathic, caring individuals who are trained to provide successful strategies for people to cope with various issues in their lives. So there are opportunities, and I can provide, Rob, some websites for you after we're finished that you might post for this. But it is an opportunity for people who have this desire to be helpful and want to do this, partly because it may be reimbursable and it involve payment, but also because it's rewarding to do.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. We'll go to Maureen now in La Crosse. Maureen, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired psychiatric nurse who lived most of my life in Chicago and worked inpatient psychiatry, acute care. So I didn't do any individual counseling in terms of office. I worked with more severe cases. Mm-hmm. But I have had a lot of, I did take classes in Chicago at the Institute of Psychoanalysis. This was in the 80s. And I have had contact with many psychiatrists in my life and many therapists, social workers, so mm-hmm. forth. And I have a, although I am not a therapist, I do have a pretty good idea of the behind the scenes.
Gotcha. Maureen, with that background, what do you think about the lay counselor idea?
I think it's a very slippery slope.
Because?
One needs to be, and this has to do not with intentions, with good intentions, but because of very complexities in relationships that form between a needy person and the so-called counselor.
Gotcha. Maureen, thanks a lot for the call. A concern, I think, Bruce, that lay counselor or peer counselor with less training might find themselves, in effect, in over their heads.
Well, Maureen, I think this is an important point to raise. We're not saying that peer counseling is a substitute for mental health services. It's an idea, or I should say a service, that would bring benefit to many people. Now, complex cases, it may be that somebody needs psychiatric or psychological intensive treatment, but it may also be true that that same person would benefit from having a peer counselor, somebody who can spend the time in an understanding way and provide support. So it isn't either or a substitute for traditional mental health services. So it's, again, because we have this shortage of trained mental health professionals, and we know that, a small proportion of those people who would be officially diagnosed with a mental disorder are able to get treatment. So this is an opportunity both for those who can't access treatment to have somebody to talk to, but also as an adjunct for more severe patients to have someone who's available. You know, if you're suffering from a severe mental disorder and you have a psychiatrist, it's hard to get an appointment. So to have somebody who's available every week or more than that, who you can talk to, who understands you and is empathic, is very powerful.
Thanks for the call, Maureen. Another concern I've seen out there, Bruce, and actually one of our earlier callers mentioned it, the concerns about the legal side, the liability side for someone who's a lay counselor or in a peer counseling situation without those maybe more medical or trained credentials. Is that a concern for you? How could we tackle that?
Well, two things, and I wanted to answer in response to several of the previous questions too. It's important in psychotherapy, in psychiatric services, but also in peer counseling, to measure the mental health status of the people we're working with. If a particular peer counselor is not helping somebody, then we need to, just as we would with a therapist, find a different counselor. And so there needs to be accountability throughout the mental health system. In terms of liability, because this isn't a mental health professional, the liability is much different. So there isn't the licensure requirements that takes place with a licensed mental health professional. So the responsibilities are different and the liabilities are different.
Time for one more caller. Jacob is with us now in Green Bay. Jacob, hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I guess I just kind of have a question. I think improving mental health, services and availability across the board is phenomenal and much needed. I guess I'm just wondering between, you know, even like a lay counselor or peer support or a licensed professional, what mechanisms are in place to kind of audit or filter someone who is right for you? I've been in counseling off and on for 15 years, and sometimes you get aligned with somebody who is really not well suited for you. So between the two, you know.
Interesting, Jacob. Finding that fit between the person seeking counseling and the counselor, Bruce.
Well, that's important. We do have some evidence that some types of counselors are better with some types of patients, but the evidence is not very strong and it's difficult to implement. What's important is you find somebody with whom the fit is good. If it's not and you have given it a good faith effort, then find a different counselor. So it's important to get that fit, but it's a very personal thing. So I advise people, whether it's a peer counselor or a therapist, that you need to go to a sufficient number of sessions. If you're not making the progress you think you should be making, discuss this with the counselor or therapist. And it may be in that discussion, it's clear to you somebody else would be better.
Thanks for that call, Jacob. And Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Bruce Wampold is an emeritus professor of counseling psychology at UW-Madison. We talked to him about recent efforts to train more non-traditional providers, including lay counselors and peer counselors, in part to help address the nationwide therapist shortage. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, help is out there. Call or text 988 or chat 988lifeline.org. We'll get some of those resources from Bruce Wampold up at WPR.org Central Time later today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, Senator Bernie Sanders proposed a new bill that would reduce working hours for Americans. It's called the 32-Hour Work Week Act. The idea is to scale back on working hours with no loss in pay. Other countries like France and Belgium have already adopted shorter work weeks at the national level. Here's Senator Sanders talking to the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions last Thursday.
The question that we are asking today is a pretty simple question. Do we continue the trend that technology only benefits the people on top, or do we demand that these transformational changes benefit working people? And one of the benefits must be a lower work week, 32-hour work week. This is not a radical idea.
The Senate committee also heard from experts who have conducted pilot studies about the workability and potential benefits of a shorter work week. Coming up in just a bit, we'll dig into the history of the idea of shorter work weeks. Our first guest is a labor economist who's been involved in the research. He's here to share what we've learned about the idea of implementing shorter work hours here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? A national law mandating a 32-hour work week with no loss in pay? Have you had a full-time job that did factor out into 32 hours a week, whether that was 4 days or spread out over more days or what have you? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lonnie Golden is professor of economics and labor human resources at Penn State Abington. His research interests include working hours, flexible scheduling, and working time regulation. Lonnie, thanks for joining us today.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a little more about what exactly is in this bill introduced by Senator Sanders last week?
Well, first, let me say that work hours get determined in part at the organizational level, at the individual level, but also at the national level. So what Senator Sanders and Representative Takano have tried to do is change the discussion to what the length of the work week ought to be as a norm, as a standard. And what's in that bill is to reduce in 4 steps, gradually phased in over 4 years, the standard work week, which we've all lived with for a couple of generations at least, from 40 hours down to 32, and preserve the time and a half pay premium or pay penalty, whichever way you want to look at it, for hours that exceed 32 in a given work week. It also has something a little bit more ambitious in there, if that weren't ambitious enough, to have a pay premium of time and a half over 8 hours in a day.
And this this bill says 32-hour work week, I believe, not necessarily a four-day work week. Is that an important distinction?
It is an important distinction, but most of us think of the 40-hour work week over 5 days, and that's what our labor historian will speak to. The idea was to codify from the early part of the 20th century a five-day work week and construct a two-day weekend. And so it's a 32-hour work week. It could be definitely spread over 5 days or even six if you think about it. But the idea is to compress the work week without necessarily having a reduction in pay into 4 days.
Now, you have looked, I understand, at employers who have tried this voluntarily without being required by law. Where have you seen these kind of experiments?
Well, some of them bubble up naturally because post-pandemic, a lot of firms had to deal with workers being out of the labor force and trying to draw them back in, or trying to satisfy workers enough so that they wouldn't leave and go work elsewhere. So I don't directly ask employers, and that's very hard to do and expensive to do, but the Four-Day Global has done these studies where they recruit firms from across a variety of industries and across a variety of countries, including the U.S. and Canada, and have found that the companies that adopt a four-day work week are given some time to reorganize themselves first, and then they're measured before, during, and after what the consequences of these are on both the employer side and the employee side. And some of the crucial findings are that, not surprisingly, the workers in these situations, and it's hourly, it's salaried, it's executive, it's shop and line worker, are all expressing important gains, like reduction in fatigue, like improvement in their own self-reported ability to be productive. And finally, especially, reduction in sleep problems, all things that feed into, at least indirectly, into productivity on an hourly basis. And that's kind of our angle in the U.S. has been thinking of productivity as how much can we work in a day, and in a week, in a year. So what this discussion is forcing a lot of us to do is to reconsider, including firms, is to reconsider what productivity means. And if it's a per hour basis, if you can be more efficient in 36 or 34 or even 32 hours as an organization or as an individual, and maybe as a country eventually, then we have all this spare time to devote toward other activities.
Talking to economics professor Lonnie Golden from Penn State Abington about the idea of shorter work weeks after the introduction of a bill in Congress that would say, hey, let's make 32-hour work weeks the norm. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lonnie, I'm sure there are concerns from different sectors of the economy. One that leaps to mind, I think, is healthcare. Even if you're very productive per hour, there still needs to be that staff, nurses and doctors on call at a hospital or clinic 24 hours a day. Would it be realistic in that sector to have a shorter work weeks for everybody?
I think what the studies are showing, it might be obviously a little bit more difficult when you have to be physically present. And but the healthcare sector has had compressed work weeks for nurses, for other staff, where they have some control, especially the senior nurses and personnel, have some control over the days that they work. And they find that this is a tremendous benefit to themselves, their well-being, and even their productivity, at least as long as the extension of hours in a day doesn't go beyond 12, because they got these days off and this rest and recovery time during the day. So it's obviously easier to implement it in some type of industries more than others, but it's not impossible, even in areas that we're used to having full-time coverage being 40 hours a week. And mind you, if there is a reduction, it just means that some of that staff would be owed overtime pay. It's not that the hours couldn't be worked.
Another concern I think that might be out there right now is we keep hearing about, at least in many industries, a labor shortage. That business owner might be thinking, well, hang on, if the norm is working fewer hours, I have to pay expensive overtime to go over, say, 32. So I'm going to have to hire more staff. This might be a hard sell at this point in the American economy.
No, that's a good point. I think the industries and firms within them that are small and low margin and are concerned about meeting new standards like this, I think that that's legitimate. Having said that, some other research I'm doing is finding that people who work part-time voluntarily are among those that get the best consequences from work. Not too many hours, not too few. So firms are finding labor shortages if they're looking for people that hit the ground running with all the skills and experience they want. And it might require that, yes, the small firm, the restaurant, the business in any industry might be able to offer some part-time jobs to cover those hours in ways that hadn't been explored before. So yes, we all fear change, but I don't think the sky is going to fall in or collapse if we do that, even on these firms.
Let's bring on a caller. Jason is with us in Cudahy. Jason, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Jason?
I'm currently working a four-day work week, but I still get generally 32 to 40 hours a week. I love it. It's really the only thing that's kind of keeping me at my job right now because of the three-day weekend, but anytime we're understaffed and I have to, like, cover for anyone else, then it gets up to the, you know, I'm working literally, you know, all day, those 4 days, and then I have no time to do any of my chores or whatever during the week, so I have to do that all during Friday, and sometimes I get kind of burnt out, but otherwise, I love it. I wish everyone, every job would have a four-day work week. It'd be great.
Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Lonnie, the benefit of that third day off, even if you cram those 40 hours into 4 days, what do you think?
I think what the caller is speaking to is exactly what these pilot studies are finding, that all the typical time pressures on a five-day week are a lot easier to handle on a four-day work week. And I think the bottom line is the companies, it's not exactly a random sample, but the companies have signed on to experiment with this. The bottom line is that 90% of them are continuing the four-day work week, and half of them said, you don't have to pilot this anymore. We're just going to adopt this. It's worked out so well for all of us. Remember, in companies, there are professionals and managers and executives. And I think there's this adjustment process that goes on. And by the way, not all of them are down to 32 hours. So like your caller said, it could be 34, 36. And realistically, there's coverage gaps. There's work that needs to be done, on short deadlines. And so some of the work will spill over into the new longer weekend, but it's not like it used to be spilling into a compressed weekend. They're finding that, you know, first of all, only 60% of the companies are doing Friday, and that's where most workers prefer it. But they're finding that you can enjoy Sunday now, whereas opposed to dreading that you got to not be rested enough to work the next 5 days. So these little marginal changes seem to be accepted by firms and everybody up and down the company.
Jason,
as well, like
Jason, thanks for the call. And Lonnie, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's Lonnie Golden, professor of economics and labor human resources at Penn State Abington. His research interests include working hours and flexible scheduling. We've been looking at Bernie Sanders' newly proposed legislation in the Senate that would bring a 32-hour work week to the United States as the norm. Coming up, a labor historian joins us for a look back at the history of workers advocating for shorter hours. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked at a company that tried shortening hours or went 4 days a week after doing five? Do you run a business that's considering doing something like this? Join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about reducing work hours, now looking at some of the history behind how we ended up with 8-hour workdays, 40-hour work weeks, and experiments with doing it different ways. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Ben Honeycutt joins us now, labor historian, professor at the University of Iowa. He's worked as a consultant to unions and businesses interested in shorter work hours. He's been studying this issue for a good long time now. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're certainly welcome.
You've written, Ben, that shorter work hours are the lost American dream. What do you mean by that?
This has been going on a long time. Work reductions, work was cut virtually in half from the beginning of the 19th century till 1920s, 1930s. No one thought the process was going to end. Took place primarily in the free labor market. People voted with their feet, working, negotiating with their employers, trading off hours to wages, that sort of thing. The upshot of which were, again, work hours cut virtually in half by people like John Maynard Keynes in 1930 predicted that we'd be working 2.5 hours a day. By 1980, his grandchildren, he said, would face the problem of leisure, which would be the greatest problem that we'd face. People like Walter Gifford, head of AT&T, talked about liberation capitalism. He thought that through the capital market, workers would be freed through shorter hours, that socialism and communism all promised liberation, but in the capital market, workers could be liberated in this process through the marketplace where people were offering their time for money, trading their time. And in that, as productivity became greater and greater, technology was able to do more and more of our work for us. Eventually, John Maynard Keynes, the most famous economist of the 20th century, said again that this short hours is inevitable, but yet we see the 4-day work week as something novel. It certainly was not. What's novel was the fact that after the 1930s, we have had virtually no increase in leisure, no shortening of the work hours at all. The predictions of people like Keynes and many, many others, no one predicted the process was going to stop. What's strange is this hiatus, this long period of inactivity when working hours have stabilized at about 40, and it's according to some estimates, working hours have gotten longer since the 1970s, two weeks longer per year, according to Juliet Shore and others. So that to me is a real question.
Yeah, what happened, Ben, to stall us at this magic number of 40 hours as our assumed norm?
That's a question that I've been struggling with for 50 years. Why did this process that seemed to be inevitable stop? I'm not sure I've answered it fully, but I've given it a shot. I've written a whole lot of stuff trying to explain the ending of short hours. I think the main thing is that we have developed a work ethic like no other civilization in history. Work has become an end in itself. For most of us, we can't imagine a world in which and this, by the way, in our discussion of the 4-day work week, leisure is sort of skirted around. Before in the 19th century and certainly into the 20th century, leisure was seen to be this great potential, offering us the chance to progress in the intangibles of life, community, family, spiritual, mind, all of those things. This is what Walt Whitman called higher progress. Free time would offer all of us, men, women, in a democracy, offer us access to Whitman said, higher progress, the higher goods of life, beyond the material, beyond making money, beyond work. There was this great possibility in the realm of freedom that we've lost contact with it. The third book, Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, is that there was a robust discussion of what leisure could mean by a whole lot of people. That again, I would hope that this 4-day work week would, the politics of it would reawaken this old discourse that used to be such an important part of this country's heritage, reawaken that forgotten American dream so that we could begin to reconsider the possibility that there's more to life. There's more to progress than just more work and more work and more wealth, more consumerism forever. Maybe there is this higher progress, a realm of freedom that we can progress in our humanity, humane and moral progress. That's what I would hope that this would eventuate into, that sort of rethinking of what progress is all about.
Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great discussion. I'm doing a play on Joe Hill right now and the Wobblies, and really learning a lot about labor history more than ever. And I think if most Americans really reached back into our own history about the labor movement in America, they would be coming at things in a completely different perspective. And what your guest just said just reminds me so much of Bread and Roses and the Lawrence, Massachusetts strike and things like that. Back in the day when there were working conditions where, you know, half the children in Lawrence, Massachusetts died before they were 6 and the life expectancy was 39. I mean, if you're going from that historic perspective, it's a fascinating study.
Tom, thanks for the call. Ben, the early days of the labor movement in the 1900s and its connection to our work hours now.
I couldn't agree more. It's a fascinating story, the history of American labor, the history of American working class folks. It's absolutely the dream, the forgotten American dream of higher progress originates in working class people in Lowell, Massachusetts, the people there in the Lowell Mills, some of the women writing for their newspapers, talk about American progress as progressively shortening the hours of labor so that every man, every woman would have access to what previously only the elites had access to, the life of the mind, time for spiritual concerns, time to read, more time to spend with the children, community. You mentioned the shirtwaist factories, the strikes there in New York City, and the people talked about deep community during those strikes, the possibility of expanding our ability with our time. Our ability to live with each other successfully, to live conviviality as a part of the American heritage. I hope we can begin to reconsider the possibility that there is wealth beyond just money, just consumerism. There's a wealth in time where we can share our lives, share our dreams. That is the last, I think, the best part of the American dream that John Thruslow Adams, he coined the phrase the American dream, and he had in mind that higher progress beyond the marketplace.
Thanks for that call. And Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
That's Ben Honeycutt, labor historian and professor at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about the history behind the 8-hour workday and efforts to shorten Americans' working hours after Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a new bill called the 32-Hour Work Week Act last week, aimed at implementing a shorter work week without a loss of pay. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the idea and maybe your experiences if you've worked a different kind of work schedule, whether it was a 32-hour work week that counted as full-time or 4 10-hour days a week. Or I know there's some plants in Wisconsin that have 3x12 and 4x12 alternating. Love to hear your experiences, how you felt about it, whether you worked there or if you're a business manager or owner who's experimented with these kind of things. Let us know about it. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the author of a new book says there are a lot of great things happening in schools all over the United States, and that we can harness that to help students everywhere learn more. Find out from the new book, The Magical Place We Call School. And if you have a happy memory of school, something that you think works in schools these days, let us know about it. Join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. When you get that layer of ice on your car's windshield, you never know what you're in for. Is it going to scrape right off on the first try? Or is it a solid layer that needs like 20 minutes of work to get enough visibility? But look at the bright side. You're able to work directly on that ice, but what if you had to do it from a million miles away? As reported by space.com, the European Euclid Orbital Space Telescope has a very thin layer of ice on it. Just one molecule thick in some cases, but enough to make its view a little bit blurrier. The water molecules are left over from Euclid's ascent through Earth's atmosphere. There's no windshield wipers. It's very sensitive equipment, but good news, there's a defrost system. Engineers on Earth can raise the temperature just slightly in less sensitive areas, just enough to get the water off, enough to get Euclid back to its job getting images of 1.5 billion galaxies. If worst comes to worst, maybe they can send somebody up with a scraper. Not it. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Many business leaders anticipate that artificial intelligence and other technological advancements will keep becoming bigger parts of our jobs and our workplaces. A recent survey from IBM found that executives are starting to prioritize people skills in the workplace over technical proficiency, thinking that technology is going to handle more of the duties that require technical skills. Things like flexibility, time management, teamwork, and effective communication are getting more valuable, supposedly at least, while more specific computer and software skills could become less important. It's creating a bigger emphasis on what are often called soft skills that aren't directly taught in schools all the time, but we learn along the way. Our next guest researches this type of skill development and says we need to stop thinking of soft and hard skills as separate things and blend them together instead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where did you learn personal and interpersonal skills like time management, working together as a team, things like that? Was it in school, on a particular job, from a role model? Should we put more emphasis on teaching them in schools, in higher education, in training at workplaces? How valuable are they to you in your workplace? If you hire people in any capacity, do you value these skills? Do you have a hard time finding them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew Hora is an associate professor of adult and higher education and education policy studies at UW-Madison. He was previously the founding director of the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
How do we define these types of skills that we're talking about? First of all, what do we usually mean when we talk about these non-technical or interpersonal or, and you don't like the phrase, we'll get into that in a minute, the soft skills?
Yeah. So soft skills typically refer to a category of human aptitude or ability that has to do with acting and thinking and just being in the world. Like you mentioned, they commonly are referring to things like communication or teamwork or critical thinking. And some other ways they're often talked about is they're generic, so they're not linked to any specific discipline like history or chemistry, and they're decontextualized, so they're not linked to any specific workplace or national borders. These are set as opposite to hard skills, which are typically the content, so knowledge of welding, knowledge of chemistry. Sometimes they refer to manual dexterity, like can you, you know, use a surgeon's knife? But this hard and soft skill dichotomy has been with us for a long time.
And you don't like that. You don't like that split, as I understand it. You've written about this. Tell us, there are a variety of reasons. Why don't you like this concept of soft skills, first of all?
So one of the longstanding critiques of the term soft is that it implies that these skills, let's say critical thinking, for example, it's easy to teach and learn. It's kind of mushy. The skills have often been gendered too, where they're effeminate as opposed to the hard skills that are more masculine. I buy those critiques. I think they're valid, but I don't think that they're real important critiques to consider. The bigger critique is that this binary of hard and soft really is an inaccurate way to think about how humans actually enact skills in the performance of tasks. And ironically, this is a conclusion that the people that invented the term soft skills realized back in 1972. There was a U.S. Army Behavioral Science Research and Development Unit. They were charged with coming up with a new categorization system for job tasks in the armed forces. They were supposed to do some performance evaluation and training. And so they came up with the system. Soft skills had to do with people and paper, and it had to do with tasks that were performed in these changeable and non-standardized contexts, like motivating troops in the field. Those were set in contrast to hard skills, which involved machines, and that had fixed context and routines for action, like changing oil in a Jeep. But after they surveyed all these supervisors back in 1972, they realized that most tasks were people and paper oriented, or a combination of those and machines. They were performed in non-standardized contexts, and they had few fixed routines or rules for performance. So they decided, let's get rid of this hard and soft binary. Let's get rid of the term soft skills, because it's just leading to misunderstanding. And they started to think about, we need to really teach and train people how to use their knowledge to perform tasks in uncertain settings. And they developed these wonderfully sophisticated training and teaching routines and curriculum back in the 70s that unfortunately didn't permeate the U.S. educational system, because we're still talking about soft and hard skills as if they're opposites.
So did that change in the U.S. Army work? Did it improve outcomes that they were hoping for?
That is where my knowledge of education and training in the armed forces is very limited. But it was really a joy for, academics like me. We kind of geek out when we find old reports and papers. And so I was reading the appendix of the 72 report, and they talk about this type of training they developed that involved role play and demonstration. So they wanted to teach leadership skills, for example. So they would bring in experienced military leaders who would demonstrate to junior officers how to do it. And then they would have the students practice that in different contexts and situations. That's exactly what really sophisticated skills education is looking like right now. Some of the best that I see is in medical education, where they've realized, for example, in oncology, that some clinicians are not very good at breaking bad news. And so a lot of medical education programs now include role play and demonstrations and simulations about how to break bad news to different types of people. And in those contexts, they're marrying their content knowledge with communication, empathy, and on-the-fly problem solving. So it's all fused into one kind of whole about how to enact our knowledge in the real world.
Matthew Hora is with us, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison, talking about how to learn job skills, distinctions between so-called hard skills, the specific tasks of a job, and so-called, though he doesn't like the phrase and many people don't now, soft skills, the communication, the teamwork, things like that, and how to train people in both, and where we could do that. You could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your experiences. How did you learn how to work as a part of a team, say, or how to communicate with others on the job? Join in at 800-642-1234. Matthew, I want to get to another concern you mentioned earlier, the idea that, okay, so maybe a college is saying, we're going to prepare students for the workforce. We're going to do some kind of program training them on communication skills, and that's going to work whatever job they go into. What I think I hear you saying is, well, hold on. Communication as part of a medical team might be one thing. From an engineer to non-engineers might be another. Customer service staff, still another thing. How important is it to connect those communication type skills to the specific context?
I think it's immensely important. One of the things that we have to realize is some of these skills, take communication, for example, they don't mean the same thing to the same people in the same context. And so recognizing that they're shaped by culture and social class and racial identity and gender is the first thing to recognize. And that impacts, I think, how we think about teaching and training them. The other is that research is pretty clear that while there's some, they call it domain general attributes of these skills, such as communication, that they're best learned and taught when it's domain specific. So that you're talking about communication in a healthcare setting or on an oil rig. Those are two actually places that we've studied. How do employers define and value communication skills in the oil and gas industry relative to healthcare? And they're really different. And so the way they're taught to students in those fields needs to recognize how they're context specific and then teach them accordingly.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Cross Plains. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what the guests would think of neurodivergent folks or folks that tend to lean that direction. I know I, with my ADHD, sometimes feel like my soft skill of time management is hindered. And at other times, it feels like it works. Similar with a bunch of other soft skills. Some I seem like I shine at. Some seem like they are intermittently good. I guess, where does he think there's, is there a place for folks with challenged brains in these kinds of skills?
John, thanks for the call. Matthew, do you have any thoughts for John?
Oh, I do. And that's a wonderful question. You're speaking with somebody who's had a few concussions and has some own unique brain functions myself. And I think this is a perfect example of how we need to not look at these skills in a kind of generic normative fashion. Again, take communication, for example. I see too many workshops that are kind of offered outside of courses about how to be a good professional communicator, right? Maintain eye contact, speak clearly, certain norms about body language. And those, again, first of all, they don't apply the same in all workplaces and in all countries. But they really don't recognize how each of us is different, and we may have different abilities and norms for communicating, and that in most cases, they're okay. They're acceptable. They should be considered normal for that person. And this is also about kind of, you know, the norms that we have and expectations we have for these skills from the employer side needs to be equally flexible, needs to recognize that, okay, this person may be coming from this national background where they don't maintain eye contact. That's not a culturally acceptable thing to do. And they need to recognize that that may be okay. Now, in some cases, it may not be. There may be meetings or, you know, other situations where eye contact is essential. And so you could teach that person, but just recognizing that we're all not conforming to the same normative stereotypes is really important.
John, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison education professor Matthew Hora about how we teach and learn what are sometimes called soft skills, time management, managing relationships in the workplace, working on teams. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How, when, where did you learn those kind of things? Do you think there are better ways to teach them? Is it the responsibility of employers to bring people on board and train them in these skills, or the education system? If so, where? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Matthew Hora, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about how we develop non-technical skills for the workplace, things like communication, organization, teamwork, often referred to as soft skills. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have about how we teach and learn those skills? Where did you learn them for yourself if you employ people? Do you have trouble finding people with those skills? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew, I want to focus on higher education here. Say a college wants to graduate students with these skills. Some students go to college knowing, hey, I'm going to go into a healthcare field, or I'm going to go into engineering, or what have you. Many don't. They're going to get the degree and then figure out the career afterwards. Since they don't have that workplace context in mind, are there meaningful ways to help develop those skills for those students?
Yes, and there's, I think, a couple of things to think about. One is that many people will not only change jobs throughout their lives or careers, but they go into fields outside of college in occupations that don't align with their major. For example, in some of the field work we've done in Wisconsin, we interviewed a number of employees who had arts and humanities backgrounds working in advanced manufacturing. And one of the reasons that they were hired was because of their flexible thinking and creative reasoning. This is what their supervisors told us. And I think that's an example where in some disciplines, teaching reasoning, creativity, critical thinking is kind of baked into the discipline, you know, art history or philosophy, for example. And if those are taught well, which they can be taught well and they can be taught less well, but if they're taught well, that should be a habit of mind or a way of thinking that the student can take into a whole bunch of different careers and occupations throughout their lives.
Do we know how to teach those things well, consistently?
Yes, I will say we do. There's a lot of great educators out there. You know, we've studied a lot of these things, how to teach teamwork or group work, for example. It's a really rich and robust literature about how to do it across the disciplines. There's entire fields of oral communication education. And so we know how to do these things. One of the problems is that most higher education faculty are not taught how to teach at all, much less how to teach these skills. And so oftentimes I think we assume that these skills are acquired by students by osmosis just because they go to college or sit in our classrooms. But that's not the case. We have to take a far more deliberate approach to cultivating these competencies within our fields.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my phone call. I was telling the person that answered the phone, these skills aren't something that a teacher needs to teach. These are skills that we're taught as we're growing up from our parents and our aunts and uncles, our family. We're taught how to communicate. We're taught how to, you know, work with other people. I just find it so hard to believe that this is something a teacher should be teaching. No, this is common sense, everyday stuff.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew, do we need schools at whatever level, higher education or primary, to be doing this stuff?
Oh, I really enjoy that question, Pat. Thank you. So in our research in Wisconsin, the top skill that we heard employers say they wanted to see was work ethic, right? And so this is a classic skill, or some people consider it a personality trait, that most people would agree formal education should not be teaching. That's something that's a responsibility of the family, the religious community, and so forth. For myself, I learned work ethic as a 4-H kid, raising sheep for 5 years. And so there's things that we acquire, like you say, through our childhood, through our families, and so forth. And a lot of people view that as the responsible party for developing these skills. I will say, though, that at a certain point, there are more highly developed or professional modes of, say, problem solving, troubleshooting, critical thinking that you could only get in a formal education setting. Now, it doesn't need to be a college degree. It could be an apprenticeship. But there are some more advanced ways of enacting some of these competencies. Again, technical writing is something that we'll learn in grade school. But if you want to be a professional writer, you most likely are going to need some more advanced training. So it's a combination of socialization and enculturation, and then some more formal training on top of that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Barry joins us now in Coon Valley. Barry, hello.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I think what the professor is talking about is an absolute essential component of a successful culture, society, workforce, et cetera. And I had 35 employees at one time, and obviously I know how important the social skills, confidence, collaboration, et cetera, are. But at the same time, we are hearing consistently that we have significant issues in K-12 school districts with social emotional skills, behavior issues, et cetera. And I would just like to introduce the concept to whoever's listening out there that if we're going to have healthy people that the professor alludes to that can learn the higher level skills, we need to put two adults in every classroom from kindergarten through fourth grade. And that's about all I have to say.
Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew, Barry wants us to start a lot earlier than, say, college.
There's a lot of research showing that these skills, if developed in pre-K, kindergarten, they last a lifetime, and they have impacts not just on increased wages, but things like, not engaging in criminal activity, health outcomes, and so forth. And so I think the earlier we can start, the better. At the same time, though, that does raise questions about the relative role of the family, the culture, the community, and formal education. The one thing I'd like to point out, though, is especially paying attention to the mental health of young children who went through the pandemic and in many cases are struggling, and we're going to see the effects of that for many years. That has to be part of the conversation of these skills, because communication, teamwork, all these things are deeply implicated in how we feel about ourselves and our state of well-being.
Thanks for that call. Matthew, just in our last minute or so, you mentioned your 4-H background as being really valuable in developing these skills. Just take a minute to tell us how that or maybe comparable programs can help not just you, but other people.
Well, if I was the emperor of the world, I would have every kid be in 4-H because I love it. One of the things I will say that in our interviews in Wisconsin with employers is we heard over and over again, not just the work ethic, but that they would hire on the spot somebody that grew up on a dairy farm. And when we pushed on that, we got, they're hard workers. They work overtime for free, things like that. But the most important thing was the ability to problem solve in really unpredictable situations. And so I think that there's things about, agriculture and working with your hands and dealing with uncertain situations, it's really important. That could be translated into formal education through experiential education, whether it's internships, apprenticeships, hands-on learning projects. There's ways to do it, and we know how to do it.
Matthew, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Matthew Hora, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He was with us today to explore how we teach and learn the non-technical skills of workplaces like teamwork, time management, and problem solving and critical thinking. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, where you learn these things. If you're an employer, what you're looking for in employees when it comes to those kind of skills, you can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a state Supreme Court ruling says religious service groups still need to pay into the workers' compensation system. Challengers may take that to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out what's at stake. And Wisconsin plays a key role in a presidential primary election. The year is 1960. The candidate, John Kennedy. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Wisconsin for Kennedy, that and more tomorrow here on Central Time.